Good evening. Welcome to the Critical Hour. We're coming to you from the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, political analyst Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
For the next 2 hours, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. After 9/11, Americans were subjected to the so-called Patriot Act under the pretext of safety and security. We must sacrifice our individual freedoms for national security. Well, Benjamin Franklin told us that those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Now, in the wake of the insurrection on January 6th, they are at it again with this Domestic Terrorism Act. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our first guest. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Sure. Always a pleasure to be here.
So Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put out on Instagram, quote, "We're going to have to figure out how we rein in our media environment so that you can't just spew disinformation and misinformation. It's one thing to have differing opinions, but it's another thing entirely to just say things that are false. So that's something that we're going to have to look into," end quote. Basically, what I take from that is she's calling for censorship. What we really need is an honest, independent media that's not afraid to tell the American people the truth and clearly explain to the public what's going on. In no matter what the dominant narrative is, there's a reason we have a First Amendment, and there's a reason that it's under attack. And that attack is being facilitated by the media. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts.
Well, when it comes to media censorship, I mean, these statements from AOC and other figures are deeply disturbing. One person's disinformation is another person's gospel truth. And that there are many different views and perspectives, and giving the U.S. government or Silicon Valley, for that matter, the power to declare some viewpoints and some reporting to be disinformation while declaring other reporting to be legitimate, wholesome, and acceptable is very, very frightening. We've seen how, foreign media has been targeted, not BBC, mind you, not France 21, mind you, but rather, independent media coming from countries, in the developing world and countries that challenge the United States on the geopolitical stage. There has been a selective targeting of them in the name of combating so-called disinformation. Meanwhile, the disinformation of the mainstream media when it comes to international issues has not been reined in at all. So I think anyone who's concerned about truth and freedom of the press, freedom of speech has to be disturbed by what AOC is saying.
Well, Caleb, one of the things that, we've seen, historically is they start off with someone that's easy, who's, disliked, Alex Jones, whatever. And then they push to, right now, they're pushing to the resistance people and the Democrats. Oh, we've got to go after these far right wingers. They're dangerous. They're going to overthrow our government. However, a report has come out that Facebook on Friday shut down the Socialist Workers' Party in Britain. Not just them, they shut down a number of their pages, and they shut down the personal pages of some of the higher ups that were unrelated. That was just their particular personal page. They just shut them down. And we see that the Facebook, that these powerful entities always go after those outside of the mainstream. So they start off arguing, we've got to start the far right. And now, needless to say, they go after the UK socialist parties and points left. Your thoughts?
Well, and I understand there has been some more recent developments in that regard. Struggle La Lucha, newspaper of a small Marxist sect that calls itself the Socialist Unity Party, they also had their page taken down recently, and Bertha Joubert CC and Cheryl LaBoche, as well as Greg Butterfield, I believe all three of them are noted for their Cuba solidarity activism, their pages were removed as well. And we're seeing a targeting of left-wing voices. There's nothing new about this and nothing really shocking about this. What is frustrating is that many voices on the left, because they are disturbed by the anti-immigrant bigotry of Trump supporters and the racist statements that Trump supporters make, don't seem to understand that if you can do one, you can do the other. And this isn't a matter of the left, shutting down the right. This is a matter of empowering the capitalist state and empowering the tech monopolies to silence people they don't like, and that. At the end of the day, the state is not the friend of left-wing activists, even if they may disapprove of the activities of right-wing activists. So I'm disappointed by a lot of confusion going on about this, but this is not shocking to those of us who followed this. It's really not shocking at all. Those of us who've noticed some of the criticism, even of Trump, coming from a very, very not good place, Trump isn't warlike enough. Trump isn't dedicated to destroying Russia enough. Trump is riling up the rabble and working people and trying to be a populist, and we can't have that. Even some of the anti-Trump rhetoric is coming from a very bad place if you're an honest left-wing, observer. So, I really wish that people would stop thinking of this as a baseball game or a football game, where you want the ref to make bad calls in your favor. You don't have to make bad calls against you. And this isn't a baseball game. This isn't a football game. This is a matter of freedom of speech and censorship and empowering the very, very powerful institutions of the society that leftists are supposed to oppose. It's about empowering those institutions to have the ability to shut people down. And if you are legitimately a left-wing activist, you know who they would prefer to use that against. So I'm disappointed by some of the rhetoric from the left, and I hope people can learn from this and that we can have a united effort against censorship.
So the argument is that, quote, the FBI intelligence analyst gathered information about possible violence involving the Capitol on the 6th of January, but that the FBI never distributed a formal intelligence bulletin, in part because of concerns that doing so might have run afoul of free speech protections. And this report goes on to reveal that in preparing for the protests that resulted in the insurrection, that the FBI did share intelligence with other law enforcement agencies, neglecting only to issue this bulletin. But the overall impression is that somehow this is a free speech issue. I think making this into a free speech issue is a red herring. It's that the FBI didn't do their job, and other intelligence agencies didn't do their jobs. Because had this been Black Lives Matter on the internet talking about storming the Capitol, the response would have been totally, totally different. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts?
Well, I think that claim by the FBI and concern for the free speech of Trump activists, they didn't do anything. I mean, that's ridiculous. I'm sorry. If people are getting together and conspiring to break into government buildings, investigating them and the possibility that they may be carrying out their plans has nothing to do with freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is about putting forward ideas, about engaging in peaceful demonstrations. It's not about, conspiring to break into government buildings.
Caleb, let me just quickly jump in and say, constitutionally and directly, that is not protect. This is your point, that type of dialogue is not protected speech under the First Amendment.
No, it simply isn't. I mean, no one thinks it is. And like I said, there have been so many cases of entrapment where the FBI gets somebody on a microphone to make a joke or something, and that is used to bring criminal charges and all kinds of investigations and all kinds of very, very loose allegations of conspiracy, conspiracy laws, right? That's the way the federal government goes after people. They claim you conspired with somebody to do something. It can be so much as a hypothetical conversation. If you were going to do this, how would you do it, et cetera? We've seen, there's a lot of people in the federal, prison system right now who never really planned to do anything, according to their defense attorney. They simply talked to somebody who talked to somebody, and that was made into a conspiracy by federal prosecutors. So, I mean, the idea that, they saw that they were planning to do this, and they saw that they were planning to break into Capitol Hill. But, they just were so concerned about the free speech of these Trump people. They decided they just couldn't do anything because they just love freedom so much. That is absolutely ridiculous if you know anything about how people have been prosecuted and treated at the federal level. So I don't buy that at all. It sounds to me like they dropped the ball and they're trying to make an excuse. Plus, they want to get into people's minds that free speech protections endanger us and that free speech protections need to be rolled back. They're playing up that old CSI law and order narrative, right? Oh, the cop arrested the bad guy, but some technicality got him off. See, we're too soft on criminals. This is the alternate reality that people who watch too much TV police dramas live in. And it's really unfortunate.
The other thing is that the discussion now about the Capitol riot being a 9/11 style excuse for authoritarianism, the Naomi Klein shout doctrine kind of thing, that now it's a very dangerous time because that happened. And now everything has to be done to fix that. And there's any number of things such as this, the domestic terrorism law, which Adam Schiff had already had, waiting in the wings. And now that it's just an opportunity for them to do the things they always wanted to do, which are going to be authoritarian crackdown. Your thoughts, Caleb?
Well, I mean, the sad thing is it's already illegal to break in Capitol. So why is a new law needed? Now, the way this new law would work, it would simply enable, harsher penalties to be imposed if you declare an act to be domestic terrorism. And how is an act to be considered domestic terrorism under this new law? It would be if they claim that you were carrying out this act motivated by ideology. So, if there's a rowdy demonstration and somebody breaks the window, generally the charge is vandalism. But, according to this new domestic terrorism law, if you argue that this person who broke the window at the rowdy demonstration was motivated by their ideology to do it, suddenly there's, this huge expansion of the sentence. And we know how this game is played. I mean, this is so prosecutors can get people to plead, right? This is when someone gets charged with breaking a window. The prosecutor doesn't actually want to prosecute the case. They want them to plea bargain. They don't want to actually have a trial. So instead of threatening the person with charges of vandalism, they threaten the person with charges of domestic terrorism. And the person is very afraid to go to trial because they don't want to go to prison for 40 years for breaking a window. So they agree to plea bargain and somebody goes to jail and doesn't get their day in court. This is about giving prosecutors an intimidation tactic with which they can intimidate people who may not even be guilty of the original charge, mind you, right? I mean, the way this works, the way the game is played, they may not even be guilty of the original charge. It's about intimidating people out of going to trial. It's a very ruthless game. Kamala Harris is an expert at this game. That's how she rose up in American politics. It's deeply disturbing, and I think any civil libertarian would be deeply concerned about the fact that one's ideology and the thoughts one has in their head when committing a crime suddenly make the crime more serious and become a crime in and of themselves. This is not what we should be doing as a society.
Caleb Maupin, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. I know you've got news you've got to cover, so thank you so much. Look forward to having you back.
Sure thing. Always a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. And to Caleb's point, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, made up of 151 organizations, has expressed their deep concern regarding the expansion of terrorism-related legal authority. And this is something that any honest American would be very, very concerned about. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by Garland Nixon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Yesterday, the 9 House impeachment managers walked over to the Senate shortly after 7 p.m. and formally delivered an article of impeachment charging former President Trump with inciting the deadly insurrection at the Capitol. Having done so, this has now set in motion Trump's second Senate impeachment trial. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. He is a political scientist and associate professor of Africana Studies at DePaul University, Dr. Emmett Riley. As always, welcome back.
Most definitely. I appreciate you for having me on.
So Democrats are building their case around Trump personally, both what he said in the run-up to the January 6th attack and at a rally that day, and how his words were interpreted within the White House and outside of it. This is according to people familiar with the deliberations. Are Democrats, as Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, said in pursuing impeachment against Trump, are they being sore winners? Dr. Emmett Riley.
Yeah, so I think that when we look at the events that occurred on January 6th, I definitely think that the offense rises to the level of impeachment. What is unclear is whether or not, I don't have any confidence that Republican senators will vote to convict. But I do think the House of Representatives is doing their constitutional duty by moving forward with an impeachment trial. Now, I do think, I also believe very carefully that Republicans, for despite all of their outrage with Donald Trump, they're still not going to abandon him, because a core part of what the Republican Party is still defined around Trumpism, so to speak. And I don't think Trumpism is a new term. Trumpism is Reagan Republicans on steroids, so to speak. So I do think that Democrats could potentially be wasting political capital with carrying on an impeachment, especially given that there is not a chance that Republicans will vote to convict. But I do think the House of Representatives is doing their responsibility. In fact, in my opinion, the case for impeachment this time is much more stronger than it was during the first time. But I am not convinced, based off of what I am seeing, that Republicans are ready to abandon him. And we also got to be clear, the white supremacist movement has been wounded, but they are not done fighting for political power. We see already the state of Georgia is moving to limit vote by mail. And so we're about to see mainstream politicians attempt to replicate the Trump model. And that's going to be quite interesting. We see Huckabee declared her candidacy for governor down in Arkansas. That's going to be one of the first test cases.
Hey, Garland, 74 million votes get you a lot of loyalty.
I'm a big believer when it comes to Capitol Hill that when politicians on Capitol Hill act, it's not about good or bad or right or wrong. It's about keeping their seats first and foremost. And so Republicans, Democrats, et cetera, they're looking at the polls. Trump still has 85% approval rating amongst the people that they need to get. They need to reelect them. And that says they ain't voting for impeachment. So that being said, to be honest, I'm a person, it sounds like you're in favor of it. I oppose impeachment pretty strongly for a couple of reasons, and I want you to respond to your thoughts on these. Number one, because there is virtually zero chance of conviction, you're wasting time at a time when you just got elected, as you said, political capital. You just got elected in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of economic disaster, and people are looking at you saying, all righty, boy, things have really fallen apart. What are you going to do to get us out? We're going to impeach Trump. To me, I'm like, you're wasting all of our time. If Donald Trump committed a crime, look, if the DOJ is going to invest that, there are avenues criminally to effectively address that. And when you know you're not going to get a conviction in impeachment, then it absolutely, if there's going to be something, it should be criminal. But I'm sitting here looking at it saying, perhaps now you should do what people elected you to do, and that's address the pandemic and all of these other things that have been botched so bad. So I don't feel like, hey, I'm looking at these people, they're really going to carry us out of it. I look at it and I'm like, they don't get it. They don't understand how bad people are suffering here, and they're still wasting time going after Trump. But I know you don't necessarily agree with all that. I want to get your thoughts.
Well, I do think that there are two things here. And one, I think that Democrats can also address the pandemic and perform their constitutional duty. But I think what is one reason why I think that impeachment is necessary, despite the fact that I don't believe the Senate will convict, is the fact that this is the first time in U.S. history where a sitting president has had an angry mob to attack a co-equal branch of government in an effort to prevent that branch from performing its constitutional duty. And so the question is whether or not, you know, I think the logic behind impeachment is the House will do its duty and allow the Senate to do its constitutional responsibility as well. But I also think we've got to step back a little bit and think about what are some of the major. I'm an institutionalist in terms of studying political institutions. What are some of the major reforms that we need to make to both the institution of Congress and the office and the executive office of the presidency in an effort to ensure that a president, a candidate like Trump, doesn't rise to power, and that even so, there are checks on his power? Because one of the things that the last 4 years revealed is just how far this particular person, Trump, was willing to test the depth of our political institutions, right? And so we have Congress members who are absolutely who are correctly worried about reelection, as you stated earlier. And as long as we have that, they're going to continue to do what's in their interest to preserve their seats. But I also think Democrats are making a political calculation as well. Given that you have a number of Republicans who are going to be up for reelection in 2022, do you force them to go on record for a second time of supporting, voting against impeachment? And really, is it going to matter? And I'm thinking Democrats are thinking that it may matter. I'm not so sure that it will. Because one of the things that we've seen consistently with this particular president is that his behavior is always going to be excused by Republicans. I think we've also got to step back and realize, too, is that he not only sent the angry mob to attack a co-equal branch of government, he sent the mob to attack a co-equal branch of government with his running mate as the presiding officer of the chamber. And I think that that speaks volumes to just how this particular candidate and Republicans have failed to step up and provide some and perform their constitutional duties in terms of oversight and holding the executive branch to its power. But I also think the political calculations with Republicans is, oh, Donald Trump has left. The nation has moved on. Let's sweep this away under the rug and call it we want to unify the country. But I do think there needs to be some accountability left, even if it's only the accountability of having Trump's record stained by being the only U.S. president to be impeached twice.
Two things. One, as an institutionalist, Trump's former key advisor, Steve Bannon, told us that their objective was to deconstruct the administrative state. And so I think to your point about he was pushing the envelope, he was doing more than pushing the envelope. He was trying to deconstruct the administrative state. And I think that comment went over the head of a lot of people. Also, I think that this trial takes place in two forums. One, the court of the Senate, and the other, the court of public opinion. And I think that the Democrats will fail in both. They're going to fail in the Senate because they won't have enough votes. But I don't think that's a reason for them not to do the right thing. They need to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. But they will fail in the court of public opinion because they don't understand narrative. They don't understand messaging, and they don't understand how to stay on message.
You're absolutely correct. I agree with everything you said, because if you think about, I think we had this conversation the last time, is that Democrats fail to advance a narrative that can stick, and they also fail to stick to stay on message. And so I think that as we talk about how bad the pandemic is out of control, most Americans aren't really worried about Trump. But I also think the political calculation that somehow holding the impeachment trial becomes more politically beneficial, I think that that's far a stretch, in my opinion. Now, I will say that when we think about Trump and him attempting to deconstruct the administrative state, that was a profound statement, and they attempted to do so. And I sort of describe it as thinking about the ways in which the institutions need to be reformed. But I also think your description of it becomes a little more accurate in terms of them attempting to blow up this big, quote unquote, administrative deep state that has some type of conspiracy or deal with it. But Democrats, I will say this, they have got to, one, address voting rights, that they will not be in power long. Two, I think that they have got to govern in a way in which they seize political power, even if that is at the expense of getting rid of the filibuster, which we know has a history of racial turmoil in this nation. So definitely, I think that these are some things that they've got to address as a, in terms of their political agenda beyond the impeachment category, because I think securing voting rights have got to be number one.
A couple of things. I don't think, you know, that the Democrats will ever really address the issue of voting, but so strongly, because parties use all types of nefarious means during the primaries. The primaries are where they maintain power. The primaries are where they ensure that the only choice that you have is a choice that has been selected by the people who run the party. So, you know, a lot of people have been, you know, flabbergasted as to why the activists can never get the Democratic Party to help them work on voting rights issues. And I just think, hey, no, parties want to maintain power and control of their party. Now, here's the other part of it, deconstructing the administrative state. My thought on that is this. When I heard that, and even now, I think back to the Grover Norquist stuff, because they've been saying that in different ways. Basically, you know, we're going to reduce the money coming into the government till we can drown it in the bathtub. The idea that I've always said is, you know, corporations want a smaller government and less people in the government for the same reason that bank robbers want less security guards in the bank. So I saw that in the bigger picture as deconstructing the administrative state, which is what the Republicans, they've got had a war on government. I mean, that's part of their ideology. Anyway, what are your thoughts on those?
So I also think that we've got to think about the ways in which white supremacy becomes incompatible with democracy and Republican forms of government. And so as we think about securing voting rights, as we think about issues like economic justice, as we think about these issues, part of deconstructing the administrative state is to take power away from the federal government so that states and local municipalities will maintain autonomy in an effort not to secure voting rights or not to extend these different rights to different groups. And part of that is that, and Democrats too are caught up in this neoliberal nonsense as well, who engages in some of these practices that I think we've got to be honest about. And part of that honesty has got to be holding Joe Biden's feet to the fire with respect to delivering substantive policies for Black people.
Professor Emmett Riley, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you. Thank you. You guys have a good day.
You too. Take care. Folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon. I'm joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
President Biden is reportedly seeking direct dialogue with Iran. Iran's UN ambassador has said that Tehran has not spoken with the new Biden administration yet. Yesterday, an anonymous U.S. official close to the administration told Sky News Arabia that President Biden is seeking direct talks with Iran and is pursuing that dialogue through European mediators. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. He's a broadcaster and journalist based in Beirut, Lebanon. He is Laith Maarouf. As always, Laith, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, guys.
So it's also reported yesterday that Iran's ambassador to the UN told NBC that Iran has not spoken to the new administration, saying no, there has not been any conversation between Iran and the U.S. after Biden came into office. What's your understanding of the dynamics here, and is this being reported in Beirut, and if so, how? What's the context?
Today there was a press conference between the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Iran, Mr. Zarif, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Russia, Mr. Lavrov, and they in one of the questions that Mr. Zarif was asked was specifically, the renegotiations possibilities with the United States. And he was very clear about that Iran will not move back to any of its commitments on the JCPOA until the United States goes back to it, that actually it was the United States that withdrew from the agreement. It was the United States that sanctioned Iran and hurt its economy and hurt its population with the sanctions hitting COVID medical needs of Iran, and that they would have no incentive as Iran to do the first step of good faith, if that's what it should be called. So the United States should return to all its commitments and actually for the first time deliver on lifting all the sanctions as the agreement says, and then Iran may return to it.
Let me ask you for your opinion, Laith, because, you know, you've been in that region for many, many years. You've been reporting, you follow, you know, this stuff very closely. You know, we have a guy on pretty regularly, Dan Lazar, who I respect his knowledge when it comes to the politics. And he says he does not expect that the U.S. will return to the Iran deal. You know, all of the buzz in the media is Biden wants to return to the Iran deal. Biden's going to return to the Iran deal. But what we see now is the Israelis, as could be expected, saying, no, we don't want you to go get involved in the Iran deal. We see the Biden people saying we're going to allow the Israelis and the Gulf states to be a partner here. And we see Iran saying, look, we had a deal. Let's just go back to the deal. What are your thoughts on, again, Dan, a guy who I respect a lot, says, I don't think the Biden people are going back to the Iran deal. Let me, Laith, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, it's very clear that, you know, the United States will not go back to the deal. Not because, let's say, Biden doesn't want it or that the Democrats were not criticizing Trump for withdrawing from it, and or the fact that Biden wrote this deal with Obama, but because, you know, it's the time has passed on that. Iran has developed much further. It has asserted its defense posture. Its allies in the region, the resistance factions, are on the rise. They have defeated the American plans in Iraq and in Syria and the Saudi-Israeli-American war on Yemen for the most part. So why would Iran go back to that point? And obviously the United States will not be interested in showing that it's weak now and to do the actually deliver on its obligations under the agreement. But in terms of Israel attacking Iran, I think Israel, if it had the power to do such a thing, it would have done it a long time ago, as it did when it attacked nuclear reactor of Iraq at the time of Saddam Hussein and the nuclear reactor of Syria that was being built before in the early 2000s. So if Israel had the power, it would have done so. And so this is just blustering. The United States also will not come to the defense of Israel in a war with Iran, which will cost hundreds of thousands of American troops, probably dead more than Vietnam. So at this moment, it's just blustering from Netanyahu. And we should be expecting that the United States is just going to withdraw slower and slower from the region as it gets more beatings.
Do you have any sense about the U.S. seeking basically back-channel discussions with Iran through members of the EU? Do you have any sense of the validity of that part of the story?
Well, Mr. Zarif was asked today, and other members of the Iranian government were asked in the last few days about this, and Iranian officials had unequivocally denied that. They said that there's only one channel of communication, which is the United States delivering on its commitments under the agreement, and everything will be fine after that. So, the Iranian parliament passed a resolution after the assassination of Fakhrizadeh, the head of the Iranian nuclear program, that gives Biden's government until February 21st to deliver on its commitments and return to the agreement. Otherwise, Iran will withdraw completely from any of its commitment. It already, Iran has withdrawn from the extra procedures of the International Atomic Energy Agency that allow inspectors to come into any location at any time they want unannounced, which means now there is no more unannounced inspections of Iranian sites. And as we see, Iran keeps on raising the stakes in order for to give incentives to the United States to return to the agreement.
The other thing is the U.S. is expanding its military presence in Saudi Arabia. They appear to be building some bases to make it a little further away, to make it more difficult to be hit with missiles from Iran. And here's the way I look at it. You know, if I say, hey, what are you doing? Lathe, let you and I talk about a peace deal so we can become friends and put everything behind us. And you say, yeah. And you say, what are you doing, by the way, Garland? Oh, I got a gun behind my back loading it to shoot you with. It kind of seems that maybe you're not genuine. So when the U.S. says, yeah, we're going to talk with Iran, what are you doing? Well, we're building bases and getting ready to go to war with Iran. If I'm Iran, I got to kind of suspect that your intentions aren't, you know, quite as friendly as it would apply. So it seems like the U.S. is already always preparing for war with whoever, in this instance, Iran, and talking peace, but their actions tend to be violent. Your thoughts?
Yes, obviously, in the last few days, the United States also announced the expansion of the missile dome that they built together with apartheid Israel to now extend to the the kingdoms in the Gulf that have signed the normalization deal. So in the next few weeks, we'll be seeing Israeli air defense systems like the Arrow system and others being installed in, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Bahrain. But also in the last 24 hours and 48 hours, there's been multiple attacks on Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, including an attack on the palace of the king, the Yamama Palace in Riyadh, by a new group that is local Arabians from the peninsula that are now going to be active within Saudi Arabia and the other states in the Gulf. So here we have a rise of a new resistance movement on the ground. They've used cruise missiles and drones to hit the palace in Riyadh, the Yamama Palace. So we have a total change of the platform of the game limitations. The United States has already played all its cards, all its allies and vessels in the region have used all their maximum power. And now there's a retreat. Anything they try to do right now is only bringing the game. The battle zone was pushed on the resistance axis before. Syria was used as a battle zone. Iraq was used as a battle zone. Yemen was used as a battle zone. Now those countries are going to be the battle zone. And that means the bases of the United States are going to be a target, not the bases of the resistance.
When you start talking about an attack on Saudi Arabia and particularly on the palace, and you mention cruise missiles, that says to me that this is quite a formidable opponent, that this is not just some ragtag group of angry Arabs, that you've got some folks that are coordinated, organized, and got some firepower. Can you elaborate a little bit on this attack?
Yes, I mean, what we've seen in the last year or so since the assassination of Soleimani, General Soleimani of Iran and Commander al-Muhandis of Iraq, is a full integration of all the resistance movements and the what we call now the axis of resistance that spans from Lebanon to Iran to Yemen, that triangle. And, we've seen with the coming of Biden, a resurgence of Wahhabi Saudi Contras, did a couple of suicide bombings in Baghdad earlier in the week, and multiple attacks on the Syrian and the Iraqi army from ISIS elements that are coming out of the American base in Al-Tanf on the border zone of Iraq and Syria and Jordan. So this group that came out of nowhere, that we now calls itself the Sons of Arabia, have now been activated as part of the resistance axis, have been given the blessings. We've seen, you know, all the resistance axis groups blessing their activities, the attack on the Yamama Palace in Riyadh, and which means obviously their activities, their weapons, their training is all integrated into within the resistance axis. And so we should be expecting more of this as the pressure mounts.
How serious of an issue is this, Laith? How concerned should the royal family be?
They should be very concerned, because this is the, you know, first attacks from within Saudi Arabia on the regime since the days of Osama bin Laden after the first Gulf War in the 1990s. And so it's different than them worrying about attacks from Yemen or Iraq. Now they have to worry from within.
Am I overstating the importance of cruise missiles being used, or does that indicate that this organization, they've stepped up their game? Because I don't know where you go and get cruise missiles just like you buy a car.
Yes, yes. Of course, it is a very serious step for somebody to use cruise missiles and drones. It's not little Katyushas or firearms.
Right. Okay. Okay. Laith Maarouf, as always, Laith, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, sir. You are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon. I'm joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
The deeper into the documents one digs, the more one finds out. New evidence is implicating FBI higher-ups in dishonesty of the anti-Trump lawyer, Kevin Kleinsmith. His crime of altering CIA documents to obscure the fact that former Trump campaign aide Carter Page worked for the U.S., not Russian intelligence. This was not simply a rare lapse in judgment, but there was a much more concerted effort to hide the facts and fool the court. What are we to make of this? For insight, we turn to our next guest. He's the editor-in-chief at theduran.com and host of The Duran on YouTube. He's Alexander Mercurius. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you again.
So this Russiagate stuff just continues to fall apart, even when you think there was really nothing left to reveal. New court filings reveal, among other things, that Kleinsmith knew much earlier than has been reported about Carter Page's cooperation with the U.S. government, and was not alone in knowing that he had provided information on the Russians to the CIA, or in covering up that knowledge. This hole is getting much, much deeper and much, much wider.
That's exactly right. And it's interesting, by the way, that you mentioned court filings, but the source of these court filings turns out to be the Durham investigation. What I understand is happening is that Carter Page, through lawyers, is bringing a case against the FBI and is being provided now with some material by the Durham investigation, which is focused on Kleinsmith himself. And it turns out that Clive Smith was very well informed about Carter Page. Apparently he was in touch with Carter Page's lawyers, assuring Clark Carter Page quite falsely at the time when Carter Page was under surveillance that he was only a witness, that he wasn't any sort of suspect, which was completely untrue, and had very deep knowledge about Carter Page, knew exactly that he had been a government source, and knew that at the time when he altered evidence, he forged evidence, which enabled the FISA court, well, which caused the FISA court to issue a warrant authorizing surveillance. And it's also increasingly clear, I mean, it's absolutely obvious, I'm sure none of us ever had doubted it, but it's now apparently becoming confirmed. There's documentary evidence which shows that senior officials, much more senior officials than Clive Smith in the FBI, like Deputy Director McCabe, his legal counsel Lisa Page, were fully aware of all this information also, and certainly had some idea of the kind of things Clive Smith was doing. So this story that we were spun, that Clive Smith did it all by mistake, he was tired, that he was stressed because he was part of the Mueller investigation, that he wasn't thinking things out clearly, that he made this slip when he forged this document, that is all turning out to be absolute nonsense. It's a load of baloney. I don't think anybody doubted that it was, and it seems that the entire FBI, from top to bottom, well, at least the people involved in the Trump Crossfire Hurricane investigation, they were all in on it.
You know, here's the interesting thing about that, because as you already know, I'm sure, whenever any institution, whenever any group is in trouble, they always want to do the few bad apples. Well, if it wasn't for this individual here who was stepping out of line, we wouldn't have had problems. But as a whole, we have done everything wrong. So what we see here now is very, very clear in that senior officials involved in the investigation were aware that Kevin Clive Smith was assertively working to mislead the FISA court. He was with knowledge, malice, and a forethought lying to go after the target of the investigation. That clearly means that this was not an investigation. This was an illegal operation. It was you can't even use the word investigation anymore, because once you start being involved in deliberate criminal acts at the highest levels, it's not an investigation anymore. This is, and you know, I've been saying this all along, this was a criminal operation. The reason I get heat is because I'm on the left and I was never like Trump and don't agree with his policies, but I do believe in the process and I oppose an illegal process against anyone, whether I support their policies or not. So I get a lot of heat on the left. The people are like, well, you're a Trump supporter. I just want the truth. But it's obvious this was a criminal operation. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. Can I just say, we need to understand the context of this. It seems that if you are able to get a FISA warrant on a particular person authorizing surveillance on that person, you are then allowed to operate surveillance against people that person is in contact with and do so at several removes from that person. So actually, when we talk about surveillance of Carter Page, there would have been a web of people who would have been under surveillance also. And clearly, what was happening is that people in the FBI were trawling around looking for evidence, not so much against Carter Page, but against all sorts of other people in order to build some kind of a case against them. Now, that is not how investigations work. I think you were an investigator yourself. You can say that. This is criminal surveillance of someone. And I'm going to say also, it clearly involves a conspiracy. Last but not least, it's a breakdown of due process. If people are lying in order to get surveillance warrants, that is very bad. And those people who criticize you, Garland, because they say you're supporting Trump by saying these things, need to understand Trump is a very powerful man, especially at that time in America. He is, well, a former president now, but a billionaire. a person of the elite. If they can do that to him, if they can do that to powerful people like Trump, like Carter Page to some extent is, they can do that to lots of other people also. Anybody of dissenting views, people on the left as much as on the right, could easily be the target of these things. And it astonishes me, given the history of the FBI, given the sort of things that the FBI has done in the past, that there are so many people on the left who do not understand it. Trump, well, you can say lots of things about him. You could say that he was, you know, an idiot. You could say that he was a fool, that he did all sorts of terrible things. Certainly not someone perhaps you want to trust with power, but you shouldn't be trusting the FBI power with power also. With Donald Trump, you can vote him out, as has happened. You can't do that with the FBI because it is an institution and it is operating in a way which is unaccountable. And we see how difficult it is to get together the evidence to prove this criminal conspiracy that they were engaged in, even though that criminal conspiracy targeted the man who became president of the United States.
And following up on that, and I'm very glad that you went that way, because that takes me right to my next point or question. As so many people in this country were so offended and disgusted and horrified by the insurrection that took place on the 6th of January, citizens storming the Capitol in an attempted failed coup to stop the counting of the Electoral College votes, people should be as offended by what we're reading now. Former FBI officials say it's unlikely Kleinsmith would have operated on his own without higher-ups knowing. So what we have is a government agency, the FBI, in the midst of this heightened surveillance state and all of this discussion about the deep state, working to undermine the validity of our elections. So as we have been misdirected to be so concerned about Russia hacking into our election and Russia influencing on our... No, folks, it's within... We have met the enemy, and the enemy is us.
You're absolutely correct. Can I just say, this is a thing I used to hear people say in Greece. There's two kinds of fascism. There's the fascism that struts in the street, and then there's the fascism which creeps in the corridors. And Greece has a long history with fascism. When I was a child, it was a dictatorship. I remember it. I lived through it. And we always used to say it's the fascism that creeps in the corridors of power, which is, in the end, the more dangerous and the more insidious. Because without it, the first, the one that struts in the streets, becomes far more difficult and far more problematic. It can't really function without the other. So when you have the principal police and law enforcement agency of the United States operating in this illegal way, you need to be far more concerned about that, it seems to me, than about the antics of those thousands of people, you know, some of them dressed in bizarre costumes with horns on their heads and all that nonsense, who invaded the Capitol on that day. I don't want to understate the seriousness of that, but it could be dealt with very fast as part of a normal police operation. This thing with the FBI is much more dangerous because that is the police itself, and that's what you need to be really scared about.
Yes. And let me add this. You know, it is absurd to argue that Kevin Kleinsmith created this information, that it went to Andrew McCabe, that Andrew McCabe reviewed it and signed it, but he should not be held accountable. Having been in that chain of command myself, as you know, I was the commander of the investigations division for a police department. I knew that anything that came out with my name on it, that I better know it was right, because I was going to be in big trouble if it wasn't right. So now I think you know, the idea that Kevin Kleinsmith was working by himself is patently absurd. And let me add this. If the FBI did this to Trump, or during the Trump, and forget Trump, during this particular investigation, then that was what they do all the time. That's the other side. What we're seeing here is this is routine operations. This is a crooked organization. They didn't do this one time. I've been a police department. I've seen crooked officers, bad officers that we'd have had to fire. I've never seen a crooked officer that was crooked one time. There's no such thing as crooked cops. You're either a crook or you're a cop. These people are crooks. Go ahead.
Absolutely. You are completely right. The only reason we know about this is because Donald Trump won the 2016 election and became president of the United States. If that hadn't happened, if that accident had not taken place, and if it had been Hillary Clinton, we would never have found out about this. Now, I don't know that this is the case, but I think it is entirely possible that the same things have been done to Bernie Sanders, to Tulsi Gabbard, to all sorts of other people. And that's and not just them. Of course, lots of other people as well, you know, community organizers, people who try and do things that are important things across the length and breadth of the United States, which some people in Washington see as sort of, you know, dangerous and dissident, anti-war people, those kind of people. I am sure, in fact, that they are the primary targets of this kind of thing. Trump is not only he is only an anomaly in that they went against him because even though he was powerful, he has some idea of making peace with Russia. Other people who are far more likely to want peace with Russia, but also people who want to make far more substantial changes to the United States, economic and social changes, a redistribution of economic power in the United States. I am absolutely sure that they are the target of exactly this sort of surveillance, probably on a far bigger scale. And if you can argue that Donald Trump, who was, what was he? I mean, he was the apprentice, the person who was running the apprentice, a billionaire, a hotel owner. You can argue that he's a Russian agent. You can say that just as plausibly against far more people. And if they're anti-war people, you can do that even more plausibly than you can say it about Trump. And that is what I think people need to understand. And it goes all the way up the command chain. Andrew McCabe, definitely. James Comey, probably. Because I think that the entire FBI was basically working to that objective.
Alexander Mercuris, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
And I'd be delighted to be back soon.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Lee. I'm joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon. There's another hour on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon. I'm joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
President Biden has to make a key decision. Is America going to stay or go in Afghanistan? As he plans to review Trump's withdrawal plan, will he seek to keep a residual presence until a government Taliban settlement is reached? For insight into this, we turn to our next guest. She's an American peace activist, one of the founding members of Voices in the Wilderness, and co-founder for Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Kathy Kelly. As always, Kathy, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leon, and thank you, Garland.
So I call this Biden's big boy conundrum. Will he stay or will he go? So it's being reported that Biden, he's going to seek to delay the troop drawdown that is currently scheduled for a complete withdrawal of 2,500 remaining troops by May, as per a February 2020 agreement with the Taliban, for what some are calling, and I heard Jay Johnston talk about this, a slower, more responsible departure. To what end? Also, if staying until a government Taliban settlement is reached, his logic seems to be setting the stage for no settlement being reached, since the Taliban wants us out before a settlement can be reached. Kathy Kelly, help me out.
Well, I think you've used the right word, conundrum. You know, if we look to what President Biden said before the election, he expressed positive regard for reliance on aerial attacks, drone surveillance and drone attacks and special forces. I'm sure the Taliban is looking closely without very, very high expectations. At least that's what they told Tolo News yesterday. Tolo News is the main news station in Kabul, Afghan run. And the Taliban said they don't think that the United States is going to concern itself very much with Afghanistan. You know, it's helpful to sort of pay attention in the various provinces where the Taliban are in control to how these shadow governments in the provinces work. They actually set up something that's kind of in imitation of the Afghan government. They have courts that are functioning. They have taxation systems. They make decisions about education. And so in a way, the Taliban already has quite a good deal of control over the country. It's within Kabul, of course, where you'd see these extremely stark differences between how the Taliban would enforce their rule and what people have been experiencing under the current government. The other thing is that the corruption that enables the opium industry to keep thriving just goes on its own course. I mean, it's not as though anything really interferes with those huge profits or the continual flow of opium out of the country. So what will happen if the United States says to the Taliban, well, we're going to slow down the troop withdrawal and we're going to ramp up our commitment to special operations? It's possible the whole dealing with the Taliban will just blow up, that the Taliban will say that, you know, you're not negotiating in good faith, we quit that agreement. And meanwhile, the Biden administration is looking over the agreement that was negotiated very, very carefully. But it's not true to say at this point that there's been any peace agreement. There's only been a troop withdrawal agreement. A peace agreement would take something far, far different in terms of negotiations and dialogue. And those talks are at a complete stalemate right now.
So, Kathy, here comes Captain Cynical. Okay. I think that not only will the position of the Biden administration blow up the peace talk, that is specifically the intent. And here's what I mean. Here's the truth. We're in an empire. The U.S. still has bases in Germany, in Japan, in Korea, right? That's 75, 80 years ago, and with no intent to move them. And God forbid that any president says, perhaps we should bring some troops home from Germany, Japan, or Korea. They'll be either, you know, they'll get JFK'd or thrown out of office. So here's my position. We are in an empire, and the empire sees two types of countries: countries that we have conquered and that we hold and that we will protect as conquered lands, and countries that we intend to conquer, and that the countries such as Afghanistan fall into the former category, and that people that think that we may leave some of these countries, we may possibly, they don't understand the nature of an empire, and they ain't been paying attention to the fact that the bases that we have in places like Japan and Germany and Korea, they don't get bigger, they get smaller. What are your thoughts on my very, very cynical position?
Well, I agree with you in terms of the United States having maintained base nation all around the world, and that there's a launching pad that the United States has within Afghanistan in range of Iran, China, and Russia, and possible control over resources under the ground. I agree the United States isn't going to want to give that up. But I do think that the military has over time begun to calculate a bit. Do we really need a sprawling base in a time when we could acquire intelligence through remote piloted vehicles and through surveillance. So I wonder if they maybe aren't so interested in keeping up with the bases. You know, China has extended its control over areas where the United States has a definite national interest in terms of the governmental Pentagon point of view. And China doesn't put a whole lot of money into setting up big, huge bases. I mean, they've got a big base in Djibouti, along with the French and the United States, kind of on the thumb of the Horn of Africa. But you wouldn't find a big Chinese base. You'd find a lot of wrangling to get control over a copper mine inside of Afghanistan, and ways to try to extend transportation routes across Afghanistan. So I'm not so convinced that the troop drawdown would be indicative of lessened U.S. interest in control. Keeping Khalilzad on as the negotiator, I think, which just happened yesterday, I think, that is an indication that the United States wants to preserve a status quo relationship with Afghanistan and with control there. But it's interesting that The Atlantic magazine just published a story that's an excerpt from a forthcoming book, which brings out again what happened with a horribly, horribly failed special operations a maneuver in 2015 when they thought they were attacking a Taliban base, and in fact they attacked a hospital, a Doctors Without Borders hospital, and it was a horrific, horrific, gruesome bloodletting as for an hour and a half that attack continued. So I think that there will be many people within Afghanistan who in one way or another have suffered because of United States militarism, and it still can function as a recruitment for joining any one of a number of insurgent groups.
Let me pose a slightly counter to Garland's question. And we know that right now the Taliban and Afghan President Ghani's administration, they're in Doha, and they're engaged in conversations about having conversations about conversations about peace. So is it possible that the Biden administration is now taking this position in order to leverage a position to get the parties to the table, but they're seriously misreading the tea leaves and they're playing the wrong cards in the wrong game?
Well, I agree with you there. That's why I've been trying to learn more about what the Taliban governance is like in the places where the Taliban has control. And I wouldn't like to live under those situations. Girls can only go to school if they go to school at home. Nobody can register any dissent. But when it comes to, you know, everyday workings of governance, the Taliban is already doing that. It's not like they're in some situation of high anxiety. They've waged vicious attacks and possibly used Al-Qaeda and ISIS to assist them at times. I think they've got much more of an upper hand. And if anybody's perhaps feeling jeopardized, it would be the governance that Abdullah and President Ghani are still trying to put together. They're having peace team negotiations between themselves.
So looking at this, how do you think that the negotiations, I mean, as far as I see, the negotiations so far have seemed pretty fruitless. Number one, am I wrong? And also, how do you think that this even discussion will affect the ongoing negotiations?
Well, I sure responded to you saying that they're having talks about having talks about having talks, and it's very dispiriting. I believe that if, and this is wishful thinking, I know, but if the United States, through existing structures in the United Nations, could make it clear that it is going to dedicate at least as much money as we spend on the war. And let's remember that there have been huge profits derived from the U.S. war spending, and it's gone into the coffers of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Boeing and other kinds of military contractors. But if we were to say we're going to put that same amount of money, now we're talking billions and billions of dollars, in an escrow account to be made available for rebuilding Afghanistan under the control of the very, very few groups who've shown that they have some competence in staying above the fray of corruption and violence, and that money is there and it's pledged. I think we owe it in terms of reparations to Afghanistan. And there could be perhaps some leverage in U.S. and NATO countries saying, we recognize that we should help assist rebuilding in Afghanistan, and then turn that money over to non-Western countries, and also be ready to help assist non-Western peacekeepers. I would like to say unarmed peacekeepers who would go into Afghanistan. And then, of course, you know, negotiate with Pakistan and with Iran and with Russia and with China and other countries to say, let's lay off using Afghanistan as an arena for our proxy wars or our, and let's say that we're all of us going to have some conscience and try to help that country and that young generation that's been so saddled with chaos and mayhem and fear and threat, help them rebuild. And let every single entity involved, every diplomat, every negotiator, every general, think every day during an intense winter about what it's like for children to shiver in huts without walls, without food. And this has gone on year after year after year.
And with that, we're not making friends, we're making enemies. Kathy Kelly, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host Garland Nixon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
As most of America finds itself in the economic death grip of a failing economy, there are some who are doing quite well. For insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy, professor of economics at St. Mary's College, and author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Always glad to join you.
So there's an article in Alternet that states, for millions of regular Americans, the end of 2020 was marked by economic distress, with millions suffering pandemic-triggered job losses, and thus the loss of their employer-tied health insurance, still waiting on robust economic relief from federal lawmakers and facing a weak social safety net. But for the nation's biggest banks, however, the year closed out with reason for celebration, and they're looking to take advantage of the banner year with a feast of stock buybacks. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times, so it seems, Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, it depends. You know, if you're a banker or a big stock shareholder or a corporation, you know, that's not in the services sector, you have had a record banner year. And it's continuing. But if you're not, you know, if you're a worker in a service-related job, it's been the worst depression since the 1930s, no doubt about it. So it's a strange, totally bifurcated economy with the suffering of those who are on the short end of the stick, more than offset by the wealth and income accumulation of those at the other end, maybe 5% or less. And, of course, the banks are at the apex of that. You know, the banks were bailed out, pre-bailed out last March and April. I mean, they weren't even in trouble, and the Fed pre-bailed them out, threw trillions of dollars at them with its QE, quantitative easing, and low interest rates. And, you know, what they did, the banks engaged in lending and stock trading and IPOs and investment banking and corporate bond issues, underwriting and so forth. Not loaning to small business. You know, loans by the banks to small businesses has declined sharply. They're not interested in that. They're interested in the big money, wealth management, they call it. And boy, are they raking in the dough. And of course, so are their wealthy customers. They're in this together and doing very, very well. And that's why you have runaway income inequality. It's those at the top, the 1-2%. The shareholders of most of the stocks, the bankers and so forth, that are making more and more and more than ever before. At the same time, you've got tens of millions of Americans who have lost their jobs, meaning no wages. Those who still have jobs, oftentimes working fewer hours, so lower wages for those that have jobs, no wages or lower wages, or those who aren't working lower hours, you know, aren't really getting wage increases. So, you know, you got 120 million people who are what we call non-supervisory workers in this country, and except for a very few sliver of those in tech and places like that, they are going backwards. So it's the strange anomaly of the very wealthy accelerating their accumulation of wealth, and the rest continuing to fall back. And there's nothing that's really being done structurally or even in terms of policy to reverse this. You know, I've recently written on my blog, jackrasmus.com, a piece we talked about last week in which this $1.9 trillion will probably get cut in half. You know, the Biden stimulus will get cut in half because the Republicans in the Senate are intent on doing that again, and the Democrats are playing bipartisan, you know, with McConnell. I had an adjective there, but I decided not to say it. you know, and that means things aren't going to change dramatically. The data that's come out here recently shows you've got manufacturing growing, but at a slower rate now. And you've got housing that was growing, but now because there's a shortage of houses, taking on a price increase, not a real economic growth, but just an increase in prices. And if you put those two sectors together, the economy that have some growth, it's only 20% of the total U.S. economy. So you got the other 80%, which is all services, which is continuing to slow down in many sectors and many geographies. So jobs availability are declining according to surveys. You're going to see on February 5th, the January job report is going to be a repeat of the December job report, which showed a loss of jobs once again. We are on the cusp of another contraction here, and I don't see the policy side of this really turning around significantly enough in order to stop a second contraction.
You know, Dr. Jack, this may not be your area of expertise, but I'll throw this at you because you're a bright person, and I respect you. Here's the other side. I think that not the other side, but I think that what has happened with the pandemic, people are like, "Well, our society is broken now, and this is terrible, and this level of inequality is unthinkable." I think the pandemic exposed just how fundamentally unfair the system is. It's not that it's broken, because it's working precisely as designed to funnel all the money to the top, you know, 0.1%, but it is now exposed. But the other side of that is, and I got to throw this out because people want to take maybe the George Floyd protest or what happened on January 6th independently. Here's what I think. I don't think you can maintain a civil society like this. I think when people look around and they see the a handful of people making $1 trillion while there's thousands of people in food lines, thousands of literally millions of people afraid of evictions, I see the tinder there, the dry tinder, and that one thing happens, Trump loses, whatever, the far right people, they get freaked out. George Floyd murder by police, those things happen fairly regularly, but there was an exaggerated response, and it should have been an over-the-top response. It's unfortunately that's been overlooked for so many years. But I think these things create the dry tinder for the slightest spark to make them blow up, and that the if what you're saying is true, it ain't going to get better. It's only going to get worse. We're going to get poorer. They're going to get richer, and I just think that creates a society that falls apart. Dr. Jack, your thoughts?
Yes, I think, you know, you got a very valid point. You know, what I think has happened here in recent months, you know, both with January 6th and all those events since the election, and then the COVID thing and the dropping of the ball on the distribution, which is really, you know, a big snafu. And I don't see that getting corrected very, very soon. People are, I believe, across the country becoming increasingly conscious that something is fundamentally broken in America today. The political system, the structure that we've seen, cannot handle the crisis that we have. You know, what was set up in 1787 is fundamentally flawed. Democracy is fundamentally flawed. We see how easy the structure of democracy can be overturned and will be next round, quite possibly. And then we see the economy and how the management of the economy has been so flubbed. Not just the COVID management, but the economy itself. And of course, the two are tied. The fact that you can have a very small minority in the Senate stopping everything and maybe, you know, thwarting democracy itself, but stopping the democratic needs of the people and the reforms that are necessary economically and politically in this country now. And it doesn't look like those kind of fundamental economic and political reforms are really on the agenda. You know, even the Democrats are like the little Dutch boy putting his finger in the dam, you know, and the holes in the dam. I don't see that there's a rebuilding of that dam about to occur. And if it doesn't, we're going to limp into 2022, and then we're going to have another explosion. And, of course, it may happen well before that summer, and the weather will break, and people will be out in the streets again. Protesting, you know, either the racism or the economy or whatever. And, you know, there's no light I see at the end of the tunnel for the solutions that are necessary, fundamental solutions to fundamentally reform our political system and our economic system, or else that discontent, which is significant, that you talk about, is only going to deepen and erupt again.
And that, as we get out, is what I think part of this Domestic Security Act is all about. This bifurcated economy creates a great disparity. This disparity leads to frustration and discontent. The folks barely afloat in the dinghies, they get angry as they're tossed about in the wake of those passersby in the yachts. And they're going to take to the streets. They're going to communicate. And that, to me, is what a big part of this Domestic Terrorism Act is really all about, being able to stifle the outrage that will stem from that discontent. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your analysis. We look forward to having you back.
Always glad to return.
You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Twitter is now implementing a new program to combat misinformation following allegations of censorship. The social media giant announced a new feature to its platform to combat the spread of misinformation. What does all of this really mean? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. He's a political activist, independent journalist, and podcaster, Nico House. Nico, as always, welcome back.
Thank you guys for having me back.
So they're supposedly implementing this new system dubbed Birdwatch. It allows users who don't have to be certified fact checkers or verified people on the website to comment and provide context on tweets that they deem to be misleading or false. I thought that's what you could do on Twitter anyway. Nico, if you were to present something which I found to be wrong, heaven forbid I could ever find that, I could say, Nico is insane, this is wrong, and here's why. So help me understand what's going on here.
Honestly, it kind of sounds like a rebranding. Because
you
can report tweets. You can just report tweets as it is. But this, in my opinion, is more so for the shareholders than anything else to make it look like, oh, yeah, we're definitely doing something different than what we used to do before. Because like at the end of the day, once again, they took off Parler from the app stores and from Amazon server, but most of the organizing was done for that stop the silver event on Facebook. And it's been well-founded that that's the case. And obviously we all know how much white supremacists have organized on Twitter as well, have said some of the ugliest things that you would find on the internet on Twitter, have trended. You know, Donald Trump has saber-rattled on Twitter, and there was no repercussion. And, of course, the Democrats saber-rattled right along with them. And yet they never got taken down. And so in my opinion, this is simply them trying to rebrand, saying, look, we're trying to do something different than Parler, and we're not going to let this happen again because we changed the name of what we already allowed. But, I mean, it's just scary because they're also, you know, we've seen a lot of encouraging of reporting people to the FBI, and it's getting real KGB-ish in here, that's for sure.
Well, you know, the other thing is you've got all of these nefarious entities that have these bots, thousands of that. For all they talk about Russian bots, we see that, you know, if we found out Saudi Arabia, Israel, et cetera, that they have huge groups of people who create who just go surf the Internet or, you know, attack people, et cetera. Right. So now Nico House says something that they don't like. Well, I think the Palestinians should get a little bit better of a deal. Well, guess what? 1,000 Israeli bots, Saudi Arabia, whoever bots now, all report that Nico House threatened me or some crap like that, right? Well, Nico, we've got 4,000 reports against you. I guess we'll have to deplatform you. So the other thing about it is it sets it up so these groups who play the game with bots can now mobilize their bots, mobilize all their people, and focus on people like you and I and Dr. Wilmer, who, you know, tend to be independent thinkers and outside of the, you know, the agreed consensus. They can focus on us and find a different way to take us out and then say, well, the reason I had to deplatform Nico, it was not us. We just got so many complaints against him from the bots. Nico.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what it seems like. There's no real accountability here at all. The main issue wasn't that Parler got taken down. It's how they got taken down. It's the fact that there was no due process. If I was taken down, there would be no due process. I mean, think about it. If it doesn't matter if you are a Democrat or Republican, but Sidney Powell, for example, was a pretty esteemed attorney that has served multiple administrations, and she was taken down for merely leading a case that the president of the United States asked her to lead. And they're like, well, we have to take her down now because, well, she's an ally of Trump. That's very scary. Because what does ally even mean in today's politics? That you said something objectively truthful about one side or the other? Or is it that you said something that the other side doesn't like? And so that they're like, you know, how we get accused of being Trump supporters, right? Oh, you said something about the Dems. That must mean you're an ally of Trump. So we got to remove you now. That's where we're at right now.
Let me add one other thing real quick, Dr. Leon, and that is, and even if you say something that's wrong, you get deplatformed for saying things that are wrong. They didn't deplatform people for saying that Assad used chemical weapons when the investigation showed that he didn't. I mean, I can find any number of things that the narratives that are pushed by the mainstream that are patently and easily patently false and easily debunked, and they don't throw them off for being wrong. So I say something about Trump, something about the election, and let's just say it's completely wrong. It's absolutely false. So now, even if you say something wrong, you get thrown out. Well, they don't throw mainstream people off for being wrong, for deliberately being wrong. So to me, you don't throw anybody off for being wrong. I don't think that's a valid way of evaluating whether somebody should be on a platform, whether they're right or wrong all the time.
As I really peel back the onion on this, and we've talked about this already in a previous story a little earlier, it has very little, if anything, to do with right or wrong. It has a lot more to do with the narrative, the dominant narrative, and whether or not you are parroting or reaffirming the dominant narrative, or whether you're challenging the dominant narrative. And this is where, to me, censorship comes into the conversation. The First Amendment protects the average citizen against censorship, and that is preventing publication of unpopular information. So the issue for me here is I'll take it out of the social media space and put it in the mainstream media space. Where is MSNBC in challenging the dominant narrative? Where is CNN in challenging the dominant narrative? Why aren't they spending more time talking about what's happening to Julian Assange and why it's wrong? See, so to me, that's where the failure is. It's not that Donald Trump is spewing stupidity around the world with his thumbs. It's that mainstream media is not providing the counter narrative to the dominant. We're not hearing about what's happening in Yemen. We're not being told the truth about what's happening in Venezuela. And those of us that are speaking to those issues are banned and chased around virtually and prohibited from telling the truth. So go ahead, Nico. I think I've made my point.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And I realized almost immediately, like, so Owen at one point was taken off of YouTube and taken off of Twitter. I think they're back on both now. But Parler obviously was taken down. But a lot of conservatives that were – or conservative channels that were deemed to be – sympathetic towards Trump were taken down, but Fox News, for example, was untouched because Fox News plays the game, right? At the end of the day, they will side with Trump only on mainstream narratives, you know, with the rare exception of when Tucker Carlson gets it right. But once Trump decides to go off the reservation, then that's a whole different conversation. And that's why they're allowed to keep their role, because they're still playing their role of controlled opposition, just like CNN and MSNBC are playing their role of controlled opposition. But once again, we witnessed gaslighting and, to be frank, lying about Russiagate from CNN and MSNBC and New York Times and all these different companies. I would say probably at this point, dozens of retracted articles regarding that situation. And yet none of them have been taken down. None of them have been labeled as fake news. None of them have been suppressed via shadow bans or an actual ban. And in fact, it's been the opposite, right? We've seen them uplifted, given special preference to the algorithms in ways that we wouldn't.
We were told that when the Mueller report was released, and Garland, if I'm wrong, please correct me. We were told that when the Mueller report was released, that Donald Trump would be led out of the White House in handcuffs.
Yep.
And when the Mueller report was released and it was found to be the garbage that it is, Rachel Maddow was in tears on television.
I remember.
Because, literally in tears, because Donald Trump was not being led out of the White House in handcuffs. But that narrative was never corrected.
Yep. It was never corrected. And not so a lot of people talk, go back to the Mueller report, but nobody ever really talks about the IG report. The IG report for me was what really opened my eyes to just how corrupt our media is and how much they're let off by the same people who are trying to suppress, you know, voices like ours for detracting away from mainstream narratives. Like that, the IG report basically admitted Obama was covering for Hillary Clinton's Clinton Foundation situation because she was being investigated by the FBI and they kept telling him to stand down and to not talk about it in public, just distract with the email situation. In addition to that, the OIG found that Andrew McCabe was guilty of basically collaborating with Clinton and Clinton donors to foment nonsense about Russiagate against Trump. And the OIG didn't even like Trump, which is probably the most important part. The OIG fired Andrew McCabe because of how corrupt, it was like obvious corruption that we saw. And so basically we found out that not only was our government officials like James Comey, Andrew McCabe had been lying to us this entire time. CNN and MSNBC had been allowing those lies to have been pushed uncritically. And yet James Comey, Andrew McCabe still have all their social media. Please explain this to me.
Well, here, let me say a couple other things I want to throw out at you. Mike Lindell, he is the CEO of MyPillow. The MyPillow guy has been permanently suspended from Twitter. He was a Trump supporter and he pushed Stop the Steal and stuff like that, which I said, okay, you can say it was wrong, but now you throw people. I mean, if you say something that's wrong, what if I say, well, I think I'm telling you, I guarantee you Tampa Bay is going to win the Super Bowl and then they lose. Do I get thrown off for being wrong? But for those who would say, well, they're going after the right wing conservatives, Facebook purges left wing pages and individual Friday. Facebook carried out a purge, including the London Bus Drivers Rank and File Committee, which was set up with the support of the Socialist Equality Party of UK. They got rid of the Socialist Workers Party in the UK. Its main national Facebook account was disabled, approximately 20,000 followers. Its student group, the Socialist Workers Student Group, 5,000 followers, et cetera. So for those who were like, yay, they're taking out Trump, they're going after Trump, the bottom line is, this is an excuse to go after anyone left or right who is outside of the mainstream narrative. And that's just what they're going to do. And they're going to use this as, and this is why people like us always oppose censorship. Your thoughts, Nico?
Yeah, no, 100%. I would tell people all the time, y'all know that this isn't for him. This isn't for Trump. This is for his employers. This is mostly for us. It's a little bit for Trump and but that's more that is more so a function of how people despise him, and therefore we can kind of like fake appease these people. But like it's a testing ground for what they can get away with for the real people that they're actually worried about, which generally are populist leftists, if we're going to look at history. So like even with Alex Jones, remember when we were like, y'all, this isn't a good thing. I don't know why y'all are talking about this like it's a good thing, because they didn't even say what the reason was. They say he violated terms of service. It's like, okay, yeah, that's cool. And it may be 3, 4, 5 months ago, that would have made a little bit more sense. But why are you removing him from your platform today? You know? And then simultaneously, why did you do it all like in coordination? They did it in coordination. All the platforms did it. So it's like, exactly what is the metric in the barometer that you're using to determine whether or not you should deplatform somebody? And we've come to figure out, like Carlos said, it's just basically if you are considered to be outside of the establishment narrative, they might go after somebody that is universally despised first, but that's just a testing ground to see what they can get away with when it comes to actually silencing the people that they're really worried about.
And as we talked about a little earlier in the show, it's, you know, all of this screaming now since January 6th that, oh, we have to do something now about domestic terrorism because all of these groups, they were communicating and planning and plotting. Well, you knew that. That was not That's not new. The problem is either y'all didn't take them seriously, or you were so in tune and in agreement with what they were doing that you didn't see it as a threat to yourselves in terms of those on the government side. So to me, it's not a matter of deplatforming these people. Let them talk. Let them rap. Act on it when they tell you what they're going to do. Do your job as the FBI and arrest them. Don't put me on the list because you don't like the fact that I came out and said some things about Barack Obama that were true, but you didn't really like.
They definitely knew. And this is the greatest surveillance state in the history of the world. To pretend like they didn't know what was coming is absolutely ludicrous. United, if you believe that.
Nico House, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
Appreciate you guys.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon. I'm joined here by my co-host, Scarlett Nixon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
There is a very good article in Mint Press News written by Alan McLeod. With likely victory of Andreas Arauz, will Ecuador join Latin America's anti-imperialist surge? For insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's a political activist with Acción Revolución in Ecuador. He's based in the United States. Ramon Mendez. Ramon, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. So Alan McLeod starts his article stating that if the country's polls are to be believed, Ecuador is set to become the latest Latin American nation to move away from the United States and elect a strongly progressive anti-imperialist government. What is going on in Ecuador right now with this election, and what type of pressures is Ecuador facing as it relates to this move towards a anti-imperialist government?
So right now we're a little bit less than 2 weeks away from the elections, and the momentum the Andres Arauz has, the candidate for the Correista movement of the Citizens Revolution or Revolución Ciudadana, it's imminent that he's going to win, as McLeod mentioned in the piece. Right now, most of the pressure is coming from the government itself, the regime of Lenin Moreno, of course, associated with the banker Guillermo Lasso, who is right now in second place in most of the polls. There's a lot of intervention from the Consejo Nacional Electoral, the CNE, which controls the elections, right? The whole electoral process. Just to give a little bit of context, the candidacy itself of Andres Arauz was contested not once, not twice, but three times. Every time it was accepted by the CNE, it was pushed back by some judge or by some official saying that it couldn't be officialized for X or Y reason. So you see a lot of the state apparatus functioning in order to undermine what would be the people's will. The majority of the people, as pretty much every poll shows, is with Andres Arauz and all the candidates to the National Assembly, to the Andean Parliament, all the candidates that represent Rafael Correa in this case, who himself cannot be a candidate or anything of the case because of these pressures. Just to give an example, in the Galapagos Islands, the candidate for Rafael Correa was not allowed to run under pressure from the state itself. The Galapagos Islands are a special area, a special designation, where pretty much every type of business or private enterprise has to be accepted by the state because it is a protected area regarding the environment and what type of businesses and what type of a living that you could do there. So every other candidate that was trying to run for the Correista movement was being threatened with being unable to do any type of business or any type of building or, you know, any type of permit for anything. So it was impossible for them to run. So there is no candidate, for example, for the Galapagos Islands, as the same way they were trying to have no candidates for the Esmeraldas province, but that problem was solved. So we see that the pressures coming from the government and the state are enormous. Right now, in the diaspora, where Acción Revolución is based, in the U.S., the precincts where we're going to go vote, they haven't been accepted yet. People know they got to vote in Queens. People know they got to vote in the Bronx, for example. But the place where they go to, X or Y building, hasn't been announced. And that's the case for the assembly members running in the diaspora in Europe. That's the same case for the diaspora in Latin America. And that's the same case for the candidates of the Andean Parliament. So you see that there's pressures from all over in order to stop not only Andrés Arauz, as I mentioned before, but all the candidates of Rafael Correa. And we have to remember that the consulates are the ones that run whatever interaction there is with the diaspora, and the consulates are run by the Moreno regime.
You know, the Ecuador's in a lot of trouble right now because, you know, all of the state services were stripped, you know, at the behest of the IMF. And the new potential president, Arauz, has basically said he's going to reverse those policies. Well, we know based on what happened, you know, we look at Cuba, we look at Nicaragua, we look at what's going on in Venezuela, that the regime change monsters in Washington, D.C. don't take kindly to that. Is there any concern? What are your thoughts on, you know, the possibility of the U.S. and their allies trying to interfere, trying to meddle, trying to screw up this election to make sure that their people are in power?
Yeah. So right now, the official discourse from the state and the government and all the candidates is that Ecuador will become Venezuela if Arauz is elected. Right. It's a thing that they would say also when Rafael Correa was in power, that we were going to become Venezuela, that Ecuador was going to become the next Venezuela. So you see that discourse being repeated over and over again. And now regarding to the IMF and other issues that come with that, the relationship with the U.S. and imperialism. I mean, Rafael Correa had a quote-unquote good relationship with the U.S. He would always say that he's not anti-American, but if they mess with Ecuador, you know, he had to defend it. And, of course, as is mentioned in the piece, he would jokingly say, well, when he kicked out the U.S. base in Manta, which is about 30 minutes away from my hometown of Puerto Viejo, he would say, well, if you can have military personnel on sovereign Ecuadorian soil, then I should be able to have Ecuadorian military base in Florida, right? If there's a problem with that, then you obviously see what's the problem with us having the base here. So besides those little altercations, he had a good relationship. I mean, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, visited Ecuador a couple of times, and there was a cordial relationship. But of course, that has changed right now. Rafael Correa and his former associates in the last government that he was in power cannot even enter the U.S. For fear of retaliation, of imprisonment, and all those types of persecution. Now, with Andrés Arauz, the idea would be that, of course, he will, similar to how Rafael Correa did with the odious loans in his government, Andrés Arauz will move away from that type of shark loan of the IMF. He will definitely try to renegotiate the loans the same way Rafael Correa did, because he knows he can do it. Rafael Correa did it. It's been done before. So now with a Biden administration, the hope is that there won't be too much of a conflict. Of course, we have to remember that the Obama administration, which Biden was a part of, was the one that orchestrated the coup in Honduras, or the one that put the sanctions on Venezuela. So, you know, it's not like a beaming ray of hope, but it's definitely a government, a new regime, rather, that it could be parlor with, that there could be negotiations, there could be discussions. The only pushback would probably be the openness that Rafael Correa's government had, and of course, the new Andrés Arauz government will have with the Chinese investment, which is a lifeline, if you will, and has worked for Ecuador in the past. But the only type of friction that I could see would be from there. Of course, if Andrés Arauz comes into power, that will not mean that that he controls the state itself, or that he's able to do as he wishes. Right now, for example, the way that assembly members were elected has changed. Now, with the Twitter method, you have to pick a whole list. So if you vote for the candidates of list one, which is the Correa list right now, the Correa party right at the moment, once you vote for one candidate, you vote for all. So if you vote for one national assembly member, you vote for all of them at the same time, which allows, mathematically speaking, allows lesser parties to have representation. That's kind of like the whole point of that method. But in the way that it's done here in Ecuador, is that Rafael Correa and Andrés Arauz's candidacy has so much acceptance from the population, is that the parties that have no acceptance, the right-wing parties, the Partido Social Cristiano, or the current government party, La 35 País, because they will have so little votes, they will be represented as a kind of this representation for a lesser party, which is just another way of stealing votes from the Correa, from the Arauz candidates. They would have to win three times as many the votes of the next candidates in order to all of them or a majority of them take place. So right now, just mathematically speaking, with the Galapagos Island case of the candidate, that there is no Correa candidate there, and with this new method of voting, around 20 seats in the National Assembly have already been taken away from Correísmo, which will make it incredibly hard to govern. If Andrés Arauz wins the government, any type of negotiation, any type of action that he will try to make with the IMF or with international partners, in this case right now he's doing a lot of pre-negotiations with Alberto Fernández's government in Argentina in order to receive vaccines, for example. If he does not have an assembly, a national assembly that backs up his work, it would be very difficult, which is kind of the point from the current regime, and kind of the point for these other right-wing parties, which of course have the support from outside forces, to any type of renegotiation, any type of deal, any type of good governance, if you will. They want to take it away from Andrés Arauz. So if anything, the support from the U.S. to these groups is going to make the difference as to see how much power they can actually exercise in the Andrés Arauz government.
We have just about 3 minutes left, and Rafael Correa was president from 2007 to 2017. He was the only Ecuadorian leader to be reelected in modern history. He's still incredibly popular, living in exile. He reduced poverty by 38% and extreme poverty by 47%. I see a lot of similarities between former President Correa and former President Evo Morales in Bolivia. First of all, are there similarities in terms of reduction of poverty and how popular they were in their countries? And is it possible that Correa could return, if Arauz is to win, that he could return to Ecuador, not necessarily in a political position, but just return the way Evo Morales walked across the border in Bolivia? Does that question make sense?
No, definitely.
Okay. Okay.
So Rafael Correa has stated that he does not wish to return to Ecuador. I mean, he spoke of it many, many times while he was in power, that his wish was to go live with his wife in Belgium, where she's from. His wish was to be reunited with his family because he was distanced from his family for 10 years, not because of anything personal, but because he was so devoted to the work of being president. I mean, as you mentioned, he was the only president reelected. He's the only president that's been in power for 10 years in decades, the decade previous to his regime, to his government, rather. There were seven presidents in 10 years, and you went from having seven presidents in 10 years to having one in 10 years. So you see the political stability change. And to answer your question regarding Evo Morales, just a little bit of context. I mean, Evo Morales was the organizing leader, Cuaco Calero, who came from the indigenous bases, if you will, or organizations, while Rafael Correa was an academic that didn't necessarily have a lot of political capital. He was never a politician prior to him being president. The only position that he had held prior to that was that of finance minister for a couple of months on the immediate government before his. So there's a lot of differences there, but the similarities of him returning, he could return, of course, but right now he has so many trials against him and so many sentences against him that if he was to touch Ecuadorian soil, he would be immediately imprisoned, which is kind of what they want to do, right? That's kind of the point. So he said,
but would some of that go away if Arauz were to win?
I mean, people were saying that Andrés Arauz was going to pardon him, but Rafael Correa has publicly stated many times that he does not wish to be pardoned, wishes to go with the process. And if that's the case, then he will be able to rejoin all his followers here in Ecuador.
Ramon Mendez, thank you so much for your time. We will stay in close contact with you as we get closer to the election and situation becomes more dynamic. I'm sure it will. Thank you so much for your time. We look forward to having you back.
No, thank you for your time. Thank you for inviting me, and I would love to come back anytime you need.
Thank you, sir. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing our voices into your space. On behalf of myself and my co-host, Garland Nixon, we hope you were informed and enlightened, and we look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. We're out.